The following program has been provided by the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project. For more information, call 1-800-735-0230 or log on to pacificaradioarchives.org.
Thank you very much. President Bowditch, President Swords, my colleagues in the Congress of the United States, members of the Chamber of Commerce, and their guests. I come here today to Worcester, to the heart of Massachusetts, a state that has supported the efforts and shared the sorrows of my life. I thank you for your reception. I thank this state and its people for everything that you have done and everything that you have meant for all of the Kennedy family. Our thoughts today are with General Eisenhower, who has served his country gallantly as the head of our armies and as our chief executive. We hope that he will prevail in this, his ultimate struggle. And today we meet at a time of international crisis. The entry of Russian troops in Czechoslovakia is a retrogression into an age we had all hoped was past. I will not comment in detail, but these events are an affront to decency and especially to a brave people who have demonstrated that they seek to be independent of the Soviet Union. For the last 10 weeks, I have not been active in public life. I have concerned myself with my family. I have spent much time by the sea, clearing my mind and my spirit of the events of last June. Some of you have suggested that for safety's sake and for my family's sake, I retire from public life. To those who have so written, my deep thanks for your kindness and for your concern. But there is no safety in hiding, not for me, nor for any of us here today, and not for our children who will inherit the world we make for them. For all of us, the only path is to work in whatever way we can to end the violence and end the hatred and the division that threatens us all. So today I resume my public responsibilities to the people of Massachusetts. Like my three brothers before me, I pick up a fallen standard, sustained by their memory of our priceless years together. I shall try to carry forward that special commitment to justice, to excellence, to courage that distinguished their lives. This is also a time of intense political activity, but I have not come here to speak for partisan interests. I come as one who will not run for office this year, to speak of things that concern every citizen of these United States. I am concerned, first of all, about the great divisions among us, between government and the people, between comfortable America and poor America, between white America and black America. I am concerned particularly that so many of our youth and our poor have felt impelled to defy our system through demonstration and disruption because they see no other way to share in the decisions that govern their lives in the ghetto or in the university or in the foreign policy of our nation. For a while this year, there was hope that the voice of the individual could be heard through the time-tested process of American political democracy. Hundreds of thousands worked in primaries and party caucuses throughout the country in a new politics of citizen participation. Surely this has been the most hopeful development of a difficult year. It would be tragic now if all the dedicated efforts of those who work for change in both political parties should count for nothing in the final choice of policies presented to the electorate in November. I am concerned, deeply concerned, about crime, about disrespect for law, about the violence and the dark disorder that so afflict our lives. Yet I am also troubled by the fact that we seem to be surrendering to the wrong answers to these problems. We have less understanding, more fear, less cooperation, more separatism, guns and gas being stockpiled against crimes and riots. But the basic causes of crimes and riots, bad schools, and housing, and no jobs, and an inadequate passion for justice, these are being neglected. Some say that only force will bring order, but arms alone will never bring security or quiet to our ghettos. People who have been eking out a bare existence at the bottom of the ladder for so many years must be convinced that the forces of law and order are also the forces of justice, honestly trying to improve the conditions of their lives. While any government is obligated to protect the lives and property of its citizens, we will not promote law and order in this country by attacking our courts. We will not meet the problem of crime by turning our backs on the Constitution. And we cannot let the new leadership of this country be swept into office on a tide of fear. This is a nation of confidence and compassion and high purpose. That is the only way that we can live. All these are vital concerns. There is another. It is the war in Vietnam. This war is the tragedy of our generation. Like most of you in the early years of our involvement, I hoped that we could help the South Vietnamese to help themselves. We hoped that a modest program of American advisors, equipment, and aid would enable the government of South Vietnam to build a nation and a government capable of attracting the support of its own people. But those hopes are gone. They have foundered in miscalculation and self-deception. They have been stymied by the stubbornness of the foe. But above all, they have been buried by the incompetence and the corruption of our South Vietnamese ally, a government that has consistently proved incapable or unwilling to meet the needs of its own people, a government that has demanded ever more money, ever more American lives to be poured into the swamp of their failure. We, to our sorrow, have met almost every demand. Almost 200,000 Americans have been killed or wounded. 25,000 have died. Over $100 billion of our tax dollars have been spent. Here were the resources to have fulfilled the promise of American life. Here were the young men to have given leadership to a nation. Here were the energies and the labors of a government of dedicated men. Here was progress to a dream of, and to work for, and to hand down to our children. Here was an America ready to give leadership to an entire world. Old allies and new friends, former enemies and present adversaries, all might have looked at our country with warmth and respect and the knowledge that this is their model of the future. It was all here, and now it is gone. It is gone, that is, unless we now resolve to bring an end to this war. Not 5 or 10 years from now, not after the expenditure of another $100 billion and the lives of another 25,000 of our finest sons, but as quickly as it is physically possible to reach the essential agreements and extricate our men and our future from this bottomless pit. Specifically, our government should undertake these actions as soon as possible. First, to end unconditionally all bombing of North Vietnam. Second, to then negotiate with Hanoi the mutual withdrawal from South Vietnam of all foreign forces, both Allied and North Vietnamese. Third, to accompany this withdrawal with whatever help we can give to the South Vietnamese in the building of a viable political, economic, and legal structure that will not promptly collapse upon our departure. And fourth, to demonstrate to both Hanoi and Saigon the sincerity of our intentions by significantly decreasing this year the level of our military activity and the level of our military personnel in the South. These steps would enable us to end our participation in this war with honor, having fulfilled our commitment to prevent a North Vietnamese military takeover of the South, and having left the future of South Vietnam to the self-determination of the South Vietnamese people. Under this plan, neither Hanoi nor Washington will try in Paris to either require or rule out a coalition government to either supervise or suppress election procedures or to determine the makeup of future cabinets in South Vietnam. None of us would urge a secession in the bombing if it would cost American lives. But two facts are unmistakably clear. The first is that while the bombing has made the movement of North Vietnamese men and material to the South more difficult, it has never reduced it. The Secretary of Defense confirmed this fact just last week. The second is that an end to the killing in Vietnam can never be negotiated as long as the bombing of North Vietnam continues. Halting the bombing would thus save many more American lives than it would ever endanger. It would make less likely a new assault by Hanoi on our troops, and it would finally test their willingness to begin serious negotiations. The Paris negotiations, as I have indicated, should be concerned primarily with the withdrawal of all foreign troops from South Vietnam. The intrusion of large numbers of North Vietnamese combat units into South Vietnam was a principal justification in 1965 for dispatching large numbers of American combat units. The withdrawal of all such troops by both sides should thus be the goal of the negotiators at Paris once the bombing has stopped. If we continue instead to insist that our withdrawal be conditioned upon the cessation of all violence in the South, or based upon the readiness of the South Vietnamese troops to take over, or tied to elaborate plans for international peace forces, I am very much afraid that we will remain there indefinitely. My objective is much simpler. As Hanoi withdraws her troops, we withdraw ours. I am not unmindful of the difficulties our withdrawal would create for the rulers of a Saigon regime. But it has yet to demonstrate either popular support or a desire to commit that nation fully to the struggle. We can, in the course of withdrawal, take steps to assure the safety of those whom we encourage to stand up against a communist military takeover. We can help construct a cohesive society as a substitute for our military presence. But the only way, I fear, that we can cause the Saigon government to broaden its base, increase its appeal, and negotiate an accommodation with the National Liberation Front is to make it clear our intention to withdraw from the South as Hanoi withdraws, and our complete unwillingness thereafter to bear the burden of their responsibilities and pick up the pieces of their failures. The government in Saigon must not be given a veto over our course in Paris, our cessation of the bombing, or our mutual withdrawal of troops. They must be given clear notice. They must be given clear notice that their chief prop will be taken away as soon as we can conclude such negotiations with Hanoi. In short, they, as we, will have to negotiate with their adversaries without a military victory. They, too, will have to make concessions. They, too, will have to work for peace. Finally, by lowering immediately and significantly the level of our military activity and the number of U.S. military personnel in the South, we would make clear both the seriousness and the good faith of our intentions, not only to Hanoi, spurring them to work out a mutual withdrawal with us, but also to Saigon, spurring their desire to talk peace with the National Liberation Front. If we follow the steps I have outlined today, I believe we can put this war behind us and reach out once again for the country we know we should be. For if we are distracted by war, divided by race, deflected from our proper course, we remain a people of great and enduring promise, as Lincoln once said, the last best hope of mankind. That hope is in every one of us. If there was one great meaning to Robert Kennedy's campaign, one ideal that fired the conscience of this nation in 1968, it was that voting every 4 years was not enough to make a citizen and not enough to satisfy a man. Rather, each of us must take a direct and personal part in solving the great problems of this country. Each of us must do his individual part to end the suffering, to feed the hungry, to heal the sick, to strengthen and renew the national spirit. It is that profound personal and moral commitment that we seek to reaffirm today. It is a commitment to passion and action in the service of our fellow man and the nation we love, to the simplest and most evident of laws, the Golden Rule, reminding ourselves every day that but for the grace of God, it would be our children staring out at our television screens with gaunt faces of starvation and the permanent pain of injustice and eyes filled with the terror of war. So let us resolve that all the sacrifices, from our earliest forebears to the young men in the jungles of Vietnam, to the presidential candidate who also gave his life, let us take from the meaning of their lives a new courage, a new conviction, a new resolve that all this shall not have been in vain, and that in our firm and unswerving determination, we can yet serve the end that he so tenderly sought for all of us, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of the world.